Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents On Station by Irving A. Greenfield, writing as Roger Jewett, narrated by Sean Compton. Chapter 1. On April 19, 1960, just as the second watch was coming to an end, Chief Petty Officer Juan Gomez, the first of the five men for the mid-watch, entered the Concorde's control room for the number 2 main machinery space. Here, two turbines driven by high-pressure steam generated by two boilers fired by superheated oil turned one of the aircraft carrier's 4 huge propeller shafts. Gomez, a short, swarthy man with 20 years' service, always arrived for his watch a few minutes early. "A beautiful night topside," he commented to Charles Hansen, the CPO on duty. Then he moved toward the opening from which the thick glass protective round viewing window had been removed. He looked down into the cavernous space and listened to the sounds of the machinery. The control room, suspended sufficiently high above the deck from the bulkhead in the corner, allowed the engine men in it to have what amounted to a bird's-eye view of everything in the brilliantly illuminated number 2 main, as it was called by the men. There were 3 more identical spaces on the CVA-60, an 80,000-ton aircraft carrier named after the Battle of Concord. Together, the 4 engines delivered 270,000 horsepower, which could move her at 35 knots. But now she was making 15 knots at the very most, Gomez judged by the sounds he heard coming from the machinery below. He, like all of the old-timers, had learned to read the condition of the various pieces of machinery by listening to their sounds. Satisfied with what he was hearing, Gomez looked at the instrument panel, where everything from the revolutions per minute of the number 2 shaft to exact temperature in the firebox were displayed on a variety of dials and gauges. From this room, the engine men controlled the speed of the ship in response to the orders from the bridge. 15 knots, he remarked, looking at the speed indicator and satisfied that he'd been on target. Then Hansen said, "Been steady that way this watch, and according to the log, the one before, too." He had a slow southern drawl. "Any word about Liberty?" "We'll have some time ashore," Gomez said, moving back to the windowless space. "Yeah, but how much?" Gomez shrugged. "Time enough for you to drink and screw, Charlie." He was still looking down at the machinery when he caught sight of wisps of black smoke coming off the equipment close to the burner basket, a large metal screen that filtered the spray of superheated oil before it entered the firebox. "Listen, just because you got married before we left the States and became a virgin again, that doesn't mean the rest of us old guys."
"Madre mia,"
Juan shouted, but it was too late. A sudden whoosh of fire burst into the machinery space. Black smoke was everywhere.
"Hit the alarm,"
Gomez shouted, breaking into a fit of coughing. His eyes teared and his throat hurt.
"Can't find it," Hansen answered. "Get the hell out of here," Gomez ordered. "Everyone out through the escape hatch. Go, go."
He counted 4 men.
"Charlie, get the fuck out of here," he yelled, feeling his breath tighten.
"Charlie!"
He dropped to the deck and felt around until he found him.
"Christ, Charlie."
He began to drag him toward the escape hatch, now totally obscured by the black smoke. His blood pounded in his ears. He felt as if his chest was being squeezed. He bumped into something that gashed the right side of his forehead. The blood poured down his face. He could feel the heat of the fire coming through the deck. Then suddenly he lacked the strength to move. He shook his head. He knew he wasn't going to make it out.
"Rose,"
he said, whispering the name of his wife.
"Rose."
And just before he let himself be sucked into the swirling blackness, he managed to conjure her face into his dying brain. Captain Jacob Miller sat down in his swivel chair on the Concorde's navigation bridge. The Concorde, CVA-60, an 80,000-ton aircraft carrier, was steaming into the eastern Mediterranean toward the Israeli port of Haifa, ostensibly for a courtesy call, but really to deliver a dozen Crusader jet fighters to the Israeli Air Force. Though the delivery was a top-secret operation, the Concorde and her 2 escorts, the D.D. Holmes and the Murray, were constantly shadowed by either Russian submarines or Tu-95s, turboprop-driven long-range bombers used mainly for anti-submarine and reconnaissance operations. Since 1800, the radar and the sonar had reported nothing on their screens. But they were steaming only 50 miles off the Egyptian coast, and Jacob was almost sure that Egyptian fighters would attempt to make a few low-level passes at his ship before they reached Israeli waters. To prevent that, he had four fighters flying cap at 20,000 feet that could be vectored onto any bogey by the ship's tactical air controller. Jacob had recently turned 50 and had taken command of the Concorde 6 weeks before in Norfolk, the ship's home port. This was the first time in his career that he had commanded an aircraft carrier. It was a necessary step on the way to making flag rank, and perhaps somewhere up ahead in the future, the real possibility of becoming the chief of naval operations. Having fought in World War II and in the Korean War, he certainly had the combat experience. He wasn't just a paper pusher. He almost smiled at his own thought. There were dozens of officers with the same qualifications. Whether he made CNO or not was up to the fates and to politics, from which even the Navy couldn't escape. Jacob had come onto the bridge because he wasn't sleepy, though it was almost time for the mid-watch, and because it was his habit to visit the bridge just before turning in. Even as he noted the escorting D.D. Holmes on the starboard side and Murray on the port, Jacob thought about the letter he'd finished writing to his sister Miriam before he had come to the bridge. Her letter had been delivered aboard by a carrier onboard delivery aircraft the day before. Despite the geographic distances that separated them, theirs had always been a close brother-sister relationship, which had been made even closer when Miriam had married Tony Trapasso, a friend of Jacob's. Tony, according to Miriam's letter, was on another trip to Saigon, with his usual stops in Hong Kong and Tokyo. The most disturbing portion of the letter was Miriam's comment that their mother, now in her late 80s, had to be put into a nursing home. Jacob was well aware that the best of them, and his mother was in the very best in the city, was nothing more than a holding place for the elderly before they died. He'd told his sister that he would foot the entire bill, and in addition, he would pay for their mother to have 24-hour nursing care. The rest of his letter consisted of chit-chat about his son, Simon, who was at Annapolis, and her son Michael and daughter Ruth. Mike was pre-engineering in Pennsylvania State and had joined the NROTC, and Ruth was a senior in high school and thinking about going to Vassar. Jacob had also written that he'd run into their mutual friend Warren Troost, who, like himself, was a captain, though senior to him, and whose son was also at Annapolis. Having mentally gone over what he had written to his sister and being satisfied with it, Jacob filled his pipe, lit it, and, smoking contentedly, thought about the events of the day. The ship's ETA in port was 0800 the next morning, and by 1000 the American ambassador and his party, which included the deputy prime minister, the admiral of the Navy, and several of his aides, would come aboard for a reception and tour of the ship. Jacob shifted his position and was about to return to his sea cabin when the watch officer, coming up behind him, said in a tight voice, "Captain, we have a fire in number 2 main." At the same instant, the fire bell sounded 3 times, indicating a fire in the aft section of the ship. Jacob winced, then ordered, "Sound fire quarters and notify damage control central." Almost immediately, the klaxon began to blare. As soon as it was silent, the watch officer came on the 1MC. "All hands, fire stations! All hands, fire stations! All hands, fire stations!" "Did the men in the control room get out?" Jacob asked, leaving his chair. His eyes went to the bridge clock. It was 23:58. "Two are missing, COPs Gomez and Hansen." At the same instant, one of the bridge phones rang. A yeoman answered it. "Damn it, Control Central, Skipper. Reports firefighters are already on their way." Jacob ordered a reduction of speed, then quickly drafted a message to be radioed to Vice Admiral Harry Foster, commander of the 6th Fleet at Gaeta, Italy, advising him of the situation aboard the Concorde. Then he did the same for the skippers of the 2 escorting destroyers. A man holding a phone said, "Skipper, damage control says it has shut down the flow of oil in number 2 main and asks permission to shut down the ship's ventilation system." Jacob took the phone from the man. "This is the captain," he said.
What's the situation down there?
Bad, Skipper, the damage control officer said. We've got an oil fire going with heavy black smoke. It's hard to get to, and the ship's uptake and ventilation system are pulling that smoke all over below deck.
Jacob realized he had no chance of making the saluting point by 0800, much less conduct a reception and tour of the ship.
Close down the ventilation system, he said, and I'll just keep headway to cut down the uptake.
Skipper, maybe we'll get lucky.
Maybe, Jacob answered, looking aft where a huge column of black smoke was already beginning to trail the ship. The phone rang again. One of the junior officers answered it. Captain, the XO can't make it through the smoke to the secondary con. He says he'll keep trying.
Jacob nodded, then to the officer of the deck, he said, Move all the aircraft out of the hangar to the flight deck.
Aye, aye, Skipper.
Jacob picked up the phone linking the bridge to the chief engineering officer and ordered a reduction of speed to 1,400 RPMs.
That will just give us steerage way, Skipper, the EO commented.
That's all I need right now, Jacob responded, and as he put the phone down, the DCO was on another phone.
One of my teams was able to get into number 2 main, he reported, but they were forced out by the heat and smoke. Mainly the smoke, Skipper.
Jacob acknowledged the report.
We're down to holding steerage way, he said.
Once we get the main fire out, we're going to have a problem with secondary fires, especially in the uptake flues.
Jacob agreed and put the phone down. On various levels above where the fire was burning were storage tanks, holding tens of thousands of gallons of jet fuel and storage areas for various kinds of ordnance. A secondary fire breaking out in any one of those areas would be catastrophic. Already, the aircraft handlers had moved several of the planes from the hangar to the flight deck.
Skipper, the Holmes and Murray ask if we need their assistance, the OOD said.
Thank them and tell them that we're managing, but ask them to stand by in case the situation changes.
Aye, aye, sir.
Jacob moved back to where the captain's chair was, but he didn't sit down. The fire would mean an investigation by a board of inquiry. It would comb the monthly hull report, and if it should find that the fire resulted from his negligence, then his naval career would come to a swift end.
Skipper, the radio officer has a message for you from the Secretary of the Navy, the OOD said.
Coded?
Jacob asked, facing him.
No, sir.
Jacob went to the phone bank, picked up the one connecting the bridge and the radio room.
Captain Miller here. Read the secretary's message to me.
Yes, sir. The message reads, Can you maintain operational status? Answer requested immediately.
Jacob waited for something more.
Sir?
The radio officer questioned.
That's it?
He asked, feeling his anger rise.
Yes, sir, that's it.
Jacob breathed deeply.
Apparently there wasn't any interest in Washington about the men or the condition of the ship. All Washington seemed to be interested in was whether or not it could maintain its commitment to NATO, which stipulated that 2 American aircraft carriers would be in the Mediterranean at all times.
Answer,
Jacob said more harshly than he intended.
Unable to say until fire is out and damage assessed.
Aye, aye, Skipper,
the radio officer responded.
Skipper, the OOD said, the XO has finally made it to the secondary con.
Let me speak to him, Jacob said.
The OOD handed the phone to him.
Pete, he said to the XO, you take the con. I'm going down to number 2 main. Hold her as she goes.
Aye, aye, sir,
the XO responded. Jacob turned, left the bridge, and hurried toward number 2 main. The smell of smoke was everywhere and became more pronounced the closer he got to the fire. Even the lights in the passageway were dimmed by swirling gray smoke. When Jacob reached the bulkhead door leading to number 2 main, a dozen firefighters wearing protective suits and under the direct command of the DCO were preparing to enter it.
Skipper, the DCO said, I've got 3 firefighting teams inside working.
Good, very good, Jacob answered, suddenly remembering another fire at sea in December 1944, when he had been air group commander and skipper of a fighter squadron aboard the Alamo.
Then the fire resulted from the planes in the hangar breaking free from their tie-downs during a typhoon. The ship was so badly gutted it was returned to the States for repair. The bulkhead door was swung open, and the firefighters,
armed with hoses that delivered foam, hurried into the dense black smoke.
Skipper, the XO reports two bogies bearing 8-5, range 20 miles, altitude 15,000, the man at the phone reported.
An instant later, the klaxon screamed general quarters and was immediately followed by the OOD on 1MC.
All hands battle stations, all hands battle stations, all hands battle stations.
I'm on my way back to the bridge, Jacob snapped and began to run.
The man at the phone relayed the message. Jacob ran down the passageway, coughing from the smoke, and up the many flights of steps to the bridge.
They're holding at 10 miles, the OOD said as soon as Jacob appeared. Our guys are vectored on them.
Jacob went to the phone bank and called the secondary con.
Pete, I'm back on the bridge. I have the con. Better stay where you are.
Aye, aye, sir, the XO answered.
Jacob returned the phone to the bank and looked at the radar display. The two bogies were still there.
Our guys could make them sweat a bit, the OOD said.
Jacob shook his head.
We don't want any more trouble than we already have. I don't want any trigger-happy Arab to start shooting.
The OOD agreed. Jacob moved to the forward part of the bridge and looked down at the deck. All of the aircraft, including those jets that were going to be delivered to the Israelis, were on the deck. There was nothing secret about them now, especially if those bogies were equipped with infrared cameras.
Skipper, DC reports that fire in number 2 main is under control, the OOD said.
Jacob turned toward him.
We're lucky, he said in a low voice. Very lucky.
He glanced at the clock. It read 0215. The OOD smiled.
Yes, I think we are.
Jacob checked the radar again. The bogies were turning.
Very lucky, Jacob repeated a third time.
Chapter 2. Tony Trapasso sat in the rear of an air-conditioned limo driven by a native Vietnamese employed by the American embassy. This was Tony's fifth visit to South Vietnam, but this time he was part of someone else's operation. He was there to make a cash delivery and evaluate Admiral Pham Khan. A man in his early 40s, Tony, wearing a white shirt, dark blue tie, and gray silk suit with 3 points of a white handkerchief showing just above the edge of the jacket's breast pocket, looked like a very successful businessman. His sideburns had just a touch of gray, enough to give him an air of dignity. Commander Peter Graubard was seated next to Tony. Graubard, a member of the American Naval Attaché's staff, like himself, was involved in various covert activities. Tony never had mentioned the fact to any of the people in the military with whom he had worked over the past years that he had once been a naval officer, a lieutenant commander, the skipper of a submarine, and the recipient of the Navy Cross. He much preferred to be a man without a past. That way, he never had to explain or defend his connection to the Mafia. Graubard made it very clear during their first meeting some months before at the embassy that he had no use for company men who only fuck up wherever they're sent. And now, assigned to Tony, he sat in resentful silence, looking out of the window at the crowded streets of Saigon. Tony leaned forward and, pressing a button, raised the bulletproof glass partition between the front and rear of the limo.
Commander, did you run a check on your contact? Tony asked. I mean, a real check. The Vietnamese military has more admirals and generals than—
I've worked with Admiral Phan Khan before, Graubard snapped. I know the man. He'll deliver what he says he will.
Tony didn't challenge Graubard, but he still didn't like the idea of having to drive out of Saigon to meet Pham Khan, especially with a briefcase filled with $500,000 in 50s and 100s. The admiral's loyalty had a high price attached to it.
I've used his men to blow ships and bridges in the north, Graubard said, still looking out of the window. Even as far as Haiphong.
He had a definite southern accent. Lighting a cigarette, Tony questioned,
And every mission was confirmed?
Graubard turned from the window. His eyes narrowed.
What's that supposed to mean? Did you confirm just how the hell was I supposed to do that?
Tony shrugged and blew smoke toward the glass partition.
You could have initiated the missions. Did initiate, Mr. Trapasso.
You initiated the missions, but Fam Can could be pulling your chain about their success, or even whether they were carried out. You weren't there to authenticate any of his claims.
Grobbard's face reddened. I have photographs back in the embassy.
Of all the missions?
Some.
They could have been faked, Tony answered.
Grobbard glared at him.
You can't be sure they weren't faked, can you?
Tony patted the attaché case on his lap. This is supposed to buy us a clean Mekong Delta. I just don't think...
The limo rolled to a stop. Tony pressed the intercom button.
What's wrong?
Smiling, the driver turned around and shook his head.
The next instant, four men carrying AK-47s and wearing black pajama-like clothing rushed at the car from an alleyway and shot out the tires.
Tony pulled Grobbard to the floor and took a snub-nosed .38 out of a leg holster.
You got one of these?
Grobbard shook his head.
There are weapons here, he said, and opened a compartment under the seat. Here, Christ, there were supposed to be...
The driver probably made sure there weren't, Tony said. He'd fought it out with the Viet Cong on two previous occasions in the uplands.
Now listen, those pajama boys will shoot the locks off the doors any moment. As soon as they do, I'll go for the guys on my side, and then I'm getting out. You follow and pick up a weapon.
Grobbard was wide-eyed and very pale.
You with me?
Grobbard nodded.
What about the money?
We're going to have enough trouble trying to save our asses without worrying about the money. There was a sudden burst of rifle fire on either side of the car. The instant the shooting stopped, Tony pushed the door open, saw the two black-clad men, and squeezing off three rounds at one, he moved the .38 left and blew the top of the other man's head off with one shot. Then he was out of the car on his belly with Grobbard after him.
Get that other rifle,
he yelled, pulling the weapon out of the hands of the first man he had killed. The two men on the other side of the car fired through the open door.
Where's the driver? Tony asked.
Grobbard shook his head.
In hell, I hope, he growled. Take the rear, Tony said. I'll belly my way around the front. When I yell go, you come up firing. Okay, start moving.
Tony wiped the sweat from his eyes with his sleeve. The gray silk suit he wore was splattered with dirt. He began to crawl. He couldn't see the driver and hoped the driver couldn't see him. He paused, took a deep breath, and after he exhaled, he shouted,
Go!
Squeezing the trigger, he scrambled to his feet. The burst fractured the bulletproof windshield. The driver ran from the car. Tony squeezed the trigger again. The driver stumbled, the back of his white shirt stained red. He struggled to regain his feet, then collapsed. Grobbard cut down the other two men.
Get their weapons, Tony said.
He opened the door opposite the driver's side. A man fell halfway out of the car. Tony frisked him.
A .32 Beretta, he said, putting the weapon in his back pocket. I got the money, Grobbard called, reaching into the rear of the car. Come on, let's get the hell out of here, Tony said. It's a long walk back to the embassy.
We just going to leave the car here? Grobbard questioned. Tony shook his head, went to the rear of the car, and unscrewed the gas cap.
We're not going to leave anything for the friends of these bastards.
Standing to one side, he struck a match and threw it into the gas tank. The car burst into flames.
Okay, let's get the hell out of here, Tony said.
Then he added, I don't think those photographs you have back in the embassy are worth a shit.
Grobbard didn't answer.
Chapter 3. The receptionist looked up, fluttered her eyelashes several times, and before she could speak, Warren said, Mrs. Troost is expecting me. I'm Mr. Troost. He was wearing his uniform.
The young woman's cheeks and ears reddened. She punched out several numbers on the switchboard.
Tell Mrs. Troost her husband is here.
She waited a moment, nodded, then, looking up at Warren, she said,
"She's expecting you. Please go right in, through the door, and turn left. Her office is at the end of the hallway on the right."
"Thank you." Warren walked through the frosted door on which the nude figures of two women were etched into the glass. This was his first visit to the new offices of the magazine The Complete Woman, of which Hillary, his wife, was part owner and publisher. The walls of the hallway were decorated with framed covers of previous issues of the magazine, several very expensive modern paintings, a few very dramatic photographs of famous contributing authors, and a dozen full-color 11x14s of nude men and women. The Complete Woman had evolved over the last few years into the equivalent of a woman's Playboy. Warren entered the office and Hillary's secretary, Joan Polk, a woman about his age, who had been with Hillary for several years and knew him, stood up and came out from behind her desk to greet him.
"Welcome to New York. It's so good to see you again."
She kissed him on both cheeks. "Good to see you too," he said, kissing her cheeks. She stepped back and looked at him.
"You don't look any different than the last time I saw you. Perhaps a bit more healthy than the men I'm used to seeing around here."
"Time at sea will do it all the time," Warren said. Until 6 weeks ago, he'd been the skipper of the cruiser Portland, but now he was back in Washington.
"Maybe a tad more dignified looking," Joan said, moving back to her desk. "How do you like our new digs?"
Warren shrugged. "Impressive." Joan grinned.
"That's being diplomatic."
Then, gesturing to the closed door, she said,
"Go on in, the boss lady is waiting for you."
"That sounds almost ominous."
"It's been one of those days," she said. "Whatever could go wrong has gone wrong."
"I know the kind," Warren responded as he went to the door, opened it, and walked into the room, immediately aware that Hillary was on the phone, engaged in what sounded like a very angry discussion. She looked up, put her hand over the mouthpiece, and said,
"Help yourself to a drink, and bring me one, too."
Then she resumed speaking to the person on the other end of the line. The brass cart, situated in one of the room's corners, resembled a turn-of-the-century street cart, complete with a slanted roof and handles for pushing or pulling it. Warren helped himself to a club soda. He poured the same for Hillary, though he was certain she wanted something stronger. He put her drink down on a ceramic coaster she'd taken out of a drawer, and then he moved to the window. It was one of those very clear early summer days. From the 32nd floor, Warren had a panoramic view of the upper New York Harbor, Governor's Island close by, Staten Island in the distance to the west, and, looking toward the southeast where the Narrows were located, the wonderful spiderweb-like Verrazano Bridge spanning them. Behind him, Hillary's voice rose and fell. He turned. This obviously wasn't the best time for them to talk things out. 2 weeks ago, when they were together in Washington, he had asked her when she intended to leave the magazine and spend more time with him.
"About the same time you intend to leave the Navy and spend more time with me," she had said.
Her answer had precipitated one of the worst quarrels they'd ever had, and she had left the hotel early the following morning, telling him in no uncertain terms that their future together was open to discussion. Warren moved to one of the walls and examined the photographs on it. Some were of models, and others were of screen and theater celebrities. The other wall had two large paintings illuminated by track lighting. One was a seascape with waves pounding against rocks, the other a reclining nude with small breasts and long blonde hair. Both had been painted by Andrew, their son, who was now in his second year at the academy and was planning to become a fighter pilot. Warren examined the third wall, where there were more photographs of famous people, including several in national politics. He heard the sudden clunk of the phone being dropped into its cradle, and, turning around, he faced her. Hillary was a very beautiful woman, with a svelte body, lovely long auburn hair, which swirled around her shoulders whenever she moved her head, and an expression of mystery on her face and in her eyes. She lifted her glass.
"I hope this has some gin or vodka in it."
"Just soda water." Hillary made a face and extended the glass to him. Please put something stronger in it. You don't need something stronger.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?